Arm took the bead from the master's hand and went to the rolls of cord and metal chain at one end of the room. Yadin was often called on to make magical jewelry using powerful stones. He was about to measure out a length of his favorite blackened metal when he realized that Yadin had said it would be a protective bracelet. Doubtless it was safer to choose protective metal as well as stones. His hand wavered between gold and brass.
"Take gold," Yadin said. "Consult your own taste."
Once Aram had chosen his chain and measured enough for his own wrist and more in the event of mistakes, Yadin pointed to a section of drawers.
"Those stones are drilled to accommodate that width of chain one way or another. I will tell you if I believe another stone will serve you better, or if I believe you should add gold spacer beads or stones for a different influence. But first we begin with protection from magic, any and all magic. What would you choose?"
Aram began with onyx, red jasper, flint, and black agate. When he added crystal quartz and garnet, Yadin snatched them from the table and replaced them with diamond and ruby. He placed 7 small round gold beads on the table, beside a long oval bead of mottled jasper.
"For visualization and divination?" Aram asked, touching the long stone.
"And to find what is hidden, uncover lies, and obtain freedom," Yadin told him.
"The gold?"
"Success, protection, good health."
"What if it doesn't work, sir?"
"You will only have yourself to blame as the customer,"
Yadin told him.
"So I would make it the best protective bracelet you can."
Aram's head was still buzzing at the thought of the costly bracelet Yadin wanted him to make. Who would pay for the materials? When he reached Cosmos's workroom, the master was seated at the work table, papers strewn around him. Looking up, he smiled and waved Aram to the breakfast laid out by the window, then bent over his paperwork again. Aram knew the signs. He settled Preet to her own second breakfast and served himself, sketching the arrangement of his beads on their chain as he ate. When finished, he put the dishes where the master's runners would pick them up and refilled his own teacup as well as the older man's. Their time was nearly done, and Aram was reading when Cosmos sat back with a sigh.
"Finally! I have to say, my boy, working out a schedule for your summer and autumn terms was no small task. I have only one question, and I am certain you will not be happy with it. You must give up one of your present classes, tribal magic or advanced charms. You may have one, but not both."
"Sir, why? I like both," Aram protested.
"And your teachers like you, which is something I never thought to hear from a Rukut. He is not the easiest of instructors."
Aram smiled. No, the teacher of tribal magic was not particularly easy, but he knew a great deal and warmed up considerably to a student who was truly interested.
"No, our problem is that Master Ramasu wishes to take you for 3 classes in a row,"
Cosmos explained.
"You are to begin work in the infirmary that serves city people outside the Lion Gate. Lindhall says that since you live in his quarters, he is certain that you will continue to learn there. That leaves you with a choice. Either you will continue with advanced charms or take a Rukut's class instead."
Aram ground his teeth. He loved both classes, but only one of them had Fozzy. "I suppose I'll stay with Fozzy and advanced charms, if that's all right, Master." Cosmos blinked for a moment, then said,
"But, Aram, that's not possible."
Preet uttered a questioning whistle. Like Aram, she was confused.
"Why, I would have thought, well, you have been busy. Fozzy has been hired away from us, if you can believe that."
Master Cosmas explained.
The Inland's Trading House has offered her far more than the university can pay to inspect and price charms for the market. It's a splendid opportunity for her,
he added gently.
You know, very few mages do well in terms of payment, particularly those who are so young. Chioke recommended her for the post. Promise you will congratulate her.
Aram drank the last of his tea.
Of course I will, Master. I've just been learning so much from her.
Cosmas sighed.
It's true. She is very learned, and we shall miss her.
He shook his head.
Shall we say charms with a new instructor, or Urukut?
Master Urukut, please, sir,
Aram replied glumly. When Aram walked into Fazi's class that afternoon, she immediately recognized the source of his sad look.
No, 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 she cried. You must feel happy for me, Aram. You must. I'll be able to bring the rest of my family here, and you know I miss them.
Preet flew over to the instructor's shoulder and twittered in her ear.
Preet is happy for me. Aren't you, pretty bird?
That made Aram smile. He loved Preet, but she was a drab little thing, nowhere near pretty. Fozzie lifted a small black velvet bag, a sign they were about to begin.
Tell me you wouldn't jump at work that would pay you as much as the university pays a master like Lindhall or Yadin, she challenged Aram.
He gawped at her. That much?
University teachers accept use of university tools, libraries, and supplies as part payment, she informed him, and housing for the ones who don't mind students everywhere. The outside world is always profitable. I'd be a fool to turn away an opportunity like this.
Now, tell me what manner of charm I hold, how strong it is, what it is made of, and how long it will last. Aram sighed and did as he was told. He would have to find excuses to visit her at her new place of work. She was so much more amusing than many of his teachers, loved them though he did. Suddenly he sat up straight.
Will the lightning snakes follow you into the city?
She laughed.
Of course they will. Once they take a liking to a person, they stay. Now, your practice, if you please.
That evening, Aram and his friends were discussing preparations for the spring term examinations over supper when Ozorn returned from the palace.
Where have you been?
Varys asked as she and Kisa rose to kiss him on the cheeks.
We thought you'd be back last night.
Ozorn slumped into a chair between Varys and Aram.
Stilowitz sailed with a fleet at dawn this morning,
he said.
His weather mage said they'd have the best sailing of the summer in the next month, and Stilowitz told Uncle he was going. There was a group of pirates off the southwest coast he just missed last year, and he means to take them.
Ozorn yawned.
I saw Mother back to the palace and had a long nap.
He undid a pouch from his waistband. Opening it, he drew out a fan decorated with gold lace. A gold tassel dangled from the end.
Stilowit heard you love fans,
he told Varys with a grin.
Oh, sweet goddess,
Varys whispered, opening it. The fan glittered in the lamplight. He handed the pouch to Aram.
He wanted you to have this. He said there is no point in getting you juggling tools since you seem to just pick up anything, toys, spoons, bowls. He thought this might be more useful.
Aram drew out a good-sized mortar made of a hard, ripple-filled gold and golden-brown wood. It was dense and heavy in his hands. Aram recognized it at once.
Lifewood, he said. Great Mithros, this is... it's an amazing gift.
And there was another object in the pouch, a lifewood pestle.
healers cherished lifewood tools. Even those with no magic could draw healing from lifewood, while those who worked spells with tools made from it increased their power several times over.
I think my cousin likes you too,
Ozorn said, smiling.
I will say this, he has good taste.
Varys laughed and fanned Ozorn. Aurum, speechless, could only turn his new tools over in his hands. They were perfect for someone about to start work for 3 hours a day in an infirmary for residents of Thak City. The Imperial University of Karthak, the School for Mages, the Upper Academy. Schedule of study, summer to autumn term, 438 HE. Student, Aurum Draper. Learning level, independent. Second morning bell, stone magic, Yadin. Third morning bell, fire magic, Cosmos, breakfast supplied. Morning classes, medicines, Thak Gate Infirmary, Ramasu, instructors. Fourth morning bell to lunch. Lunch, noon bell, afternoon classes. Tribal magic, Urukut Ahilip. Illusions, small animals, Dagani. Water magic, Sibo. Plants, Hulak. Supper, seventh afternoon bell, extra study at need. Chapter 16. June to September 2nd, 438. The main thing Aurum remembered from the spring examinations was his goodbye to Fazi. He had paid Yadin some of his carefully saved money for the silver materials, slender chain, double loop clasp setting, and a beautiful piece of jade, both for calm and prosperity. Even Yadin, who was difficult to please, praised the necklace when it was done. Fazi wept when he presented it to her on the last day of class and allowed him to help her put it on. She laughed when he showed her the mark he had engraved on the clasp, a tiny lightning bolt.
I won't worry about your prosperity, she told him before he left for Dagani's class. I know that one day everyone will know who you are. You should start to think about a mage name.
She's right,
Tristan said when Aurum told his friends about it at supper.
Aurum Draper isn't the sort of name to inspire awe. No one is ever going to learn what my name was before I changed it.
Maurice leaned her chin on her hand. Something dark and mysterious, like you're growing to be. Though I'll miss Aurum.
I'd feel silly with a grand name,
Aurum said, feeding Preet bits of fruit.
And I have to keep mine,
Ozorn said. They gathered up their dishes and left the dining hall to work on their studies. The discussion was over, but every now and then Aurum would toy with the idea, trying out new names and laughing at his efforts. When the marks were posted, Aurum was pleased with his. He was even with Ozorn and Varys in the classes they shared, which was all that mattered. Tristan and Gisa did well enough in their own classes that they mustered a group of friends and headed into the city to celebrate. Aurum, Ozorn, and Varys retreated to the menagerie, where new leopard cubs had just arrived. The friends' week of relaxation was done before they knew it, and Aurum was pitched into his new schedule. He dimly realized at some point that he had expected to be making more medicines for Ramasu at the infirmary. In truth, that was part of his work, as was mopping, scrubbing, fetching materials for older helpers, and guiding patients to the rooms where they would be cared for and given a bed if necessary. He had been there a month when one of the older students grabbed him by the arm and hauled him into an examining room. Ramasu stood by a weathered, skinny man who sat on the work table. The man wore a plain old shirt, breeches, and sandals, as well as a thick, dirty rag wrapped around one arm.
Water, clean clothes, cleansing liquid,
Ramasu ordered. Aurum turned to get those things, but Ramasu said,
Not you, Aurum. Garb will do it.
The student who had brought Aram there left the room.
This is Daka. He is a farmer from one of the villages to the south. Daka, my student, Aram.
The man nodded shyly to Aram.
Daka had an accident a week ago and waited until now to come to us,
Ramasu said with reproach. Daka glared at the master.
It's planting time,
he retorted, as if Ramasu had forgotten a central aspect of life.
My woman is near to popping with another babe, so she's no help. The elder two is some use, but she needs them at the house and the home garden.
He smiled.
Him and the girl is hard workers, and a help to their ma.
And how did you hurt your arm?
Ramasu asked. Aram was startled. Talking with the farmer, his reserved and aloof master was gentle, even kind. Daka growled.
I tripped coming in from the field and hit a sharp-edged rock. It wasn't too deep, so my woman washed it in vinegar for me and wrapped it up. I didn't think no more of it till the thing leaked through the wrap. I took it off and the thing were all swole up. I put a clean cloth on it, but it hurts and hurts.
Were there herbs in the vinegar?
Ramasu asked.
Bits of leaves or sticks?
She puts plants in it for flavor,
Daka snapped.
Everyone does.
The student Gerb returned with the requested supplies and laid them out on the table ready for use.
Shall I remove the bandage, master?
He asked Ramasu. The master shook his head.
Aram will do it. You prepare a wet cloth. I will be ready to hold Daka's arm if it is needful.
Ramasu looked at the farmer.
We are cautious only because this cloth may now be stuck to your arm. I'd like you to hold still if you would be so good.
Daka looked at Ramasu, then Aram, gulped and nodded. He held out the arm.
Wash your hands in the fountain,
Ramasu instructed Aram.
Use the soap, touch nothing once they're clean, until you hold Daka's arm. Where is the injury?
Aram could see the swelling of the cloth on the underside of Daka's forearm, but the man pointed it out anyway. The rising flesh under the bandage reached from the farmer's wrist almost to his elbow. Aram hurried over to wash. When he finished, he shook the excess water from his hands as he had seen Ramasu do. Then he walked over to Daka and undid the knot on his grubby bandage. Gently, Ramasu raised the farmer's arm until it bent in an L shape. Aram would be able to look directly at the injury when he bared it.
You should see Aram in class,
Ramasu told Daka as Aram carefully unwound the bandage from the farmer and wrapped it around one of his own hands.
He has a bird the size of a small blackbird that goes nearly everywhere with him.
Aram lost track of what the master was saying. In the lean flesh under the bandage, he felt something wrong, just as he had felt something wrong when he worked with sick animals. If he went by what he knew of animals, the man had an infection, a bad one. Already he could see yellowish leakage on the bandage, then brown old blood on the last few layers. These were not inclined to come away from Daka's skin. The man grunted.
I'm sorry, Aram said. I'll take one more small pull, and if that doesn't give, we can soak it a little too.
He tugged gently on the cloth.
Here,
Ramasu told him. Aram reached out with his gift to feel what the master did with a touch of his own power and the sigil for release. The cloth yanked free of the wound, peeling away dried blood and other matter. Pus and blood spurted, splattering Aram's face and shirt. Instinctively, he kept his mouth and eyes closed until he felt no more fresh liquid. Then he grabbed the cloth over his shoulder and wrapped it tightly around Daka's wrist, stopping the flow of blood and matter. For a moment, none of them said or did anything else. Then Gerb soaked a cloth in the warm water he had brought and began to clean Daka's arm.
Slowly, Aram unwound the clean cloth until he could see the wound. It oozed sluggishly, an abscess that would have killed the man without treatment.
"That seems bad," Daka remarked.
He looked at Ramasu, his eyes filled with terror.
"If I get my arm cut off, my family will starve."
"It's no cutting matter,"
the master said kindly, resting his hand on Daka's good shoulder.
"Watch. Aram, I understand you know the basics for the sharing of power."
"But that was marble," Aram cried.
Ramasu nodded.
"The combining of our power is much the same. I discussed it with Yadin a while ago. The difference is in the lines. Instead of fibers within stone, we will work in terms of nerves. And you will not lend power this time. You will work as part of me, learning this kind of mending spell as you go."
Worried, marble was far less vulnerable to his sort of mistake than a human body would be, Aram glanced at Gerb. The older student shrugged.
"It's how he dunked me into the river of healing," he said. "I didn't drown. And I hear you're clever."
He grinned.
"You just experienced a small sample and lived," Ramasu pointed out.
Daka glared at Aram.
"If you might get on, boy," he demanded. "I have chores at home."
He looked at Ramasu.
"I'll be able to do me chores."
That settled Aram. He knew as well as the farmer that the loss of a day's work might mean a loss of some part of his family's meals. Besides, there was a baby coming.
"What must I do?"
Ramasu glanced at Gerb.
"I will have a poultice, the emphasized honey."
Before he finished, Gerb said, "Turmeric and olive leaf extract, boiled linen poultice, cotton bandage." He looked at Aram and explained, "He thinks I never remember anything. It's his favorite mixture for an open wound. In a month you'll be saying it in your sleep." As he walked out, Ramasu muttered,
"I do not get my proper portion of respect."
"Me? I like a youngster with spice,"
Daka told him. He was a little gray and beginning to sweat. Without instructions, Aram began to clear the table of the things they had placed there before. One of the shelves was stacked with blankets. Aram took two and placed the first on the table. To his awe, Ramasu picked Daka up in both arms and gently set him on the blanket, then took the other from Aram and covered the farmer with it. Aram kept the wounded arm clear of the cloth and placed it across Daka's chest when Ramasu was done.
"Now you let us work," Ramasu told Daka. "When you wake, your wound will be clean and bandaged, and in 2 days you may remove the bandage."
Aram yawned and glanced at Daka. The farmer was asleep.
"Not you," Ramasu ordered. "Let us link together."
It began that way. At the end of the morning, Ramasu handed Aram a battered volume titled Master and Student.
"It is so slow the other way,"
Ramasu told Aram as the youth leafed through the volume.
"I have perhaps a handful of students a year who I can teach this way, and not all of them care for it. We reinforce what we learn through magic with studies you will undertake using this volume and in the infirmaries. You can learn just as much from the nurses and the senior students."
Aram nodded, remembering the staff at the typhoid infirmary.
"And it may be that you will decide the medical arts are not for you. If that is the case, I must know right away. I do not have so much time that I can waste it on someone who dislikes the work."
"Oh, no, master," Aram replied, shocked. "This is so much better than things like battle magic or studying what will earn me a place among the wealthy."
Ramasu smiled.
"You are young. You may change your mind. And if you enter Ozorn's house, you will labor for him as much as for the sick, remember."
He urged Aram through the door closest to the university's main entrance.
"Have a good meal,"
You will need it after all you have done today.
And read that material tonight.
When Aram returned to the infirmary in the morning, it was to the knowledge that Daka's wife had presented him with a new son. The next month was something of a blur in his memory until he got used to his new schedule. The infirmary and Lindhall kept him moving, and Hulak was all too happy to step up his learning with regard to medicinal plants. Yadin decided that he'd done so well in making spells that came from magical jewelry that he increased Aram's studies in that area at the same time that Cosmas began to teach him about the uses of fire in the university kitchens. Dagani brought their small class of three to the next step, that of simulacra of small animals, but Ozorn, Baris, and Aram expected that. There the difficulty lay in the creation of believable simulacra of living creatures. They had done well with birds, but small animals, particularly pets, were more difficult. And Arukut decided that Aram was ready to learn magic from tribes that had vanished centuries before, leaving only their statues and stone markers behind. Worst of all, from Aram's point of view, Faris was angry with him for 3 weeks. She told him it was because he had snubbed two girls she had introduced to him. Ozorn told him privately that he simply wasn't paying attention to her the way he had before that term.
"I think it's the falling asleep over supper, frankly,"
his friend added with a grin. Aram tried to scowl at him, but couldn't.
"What do you suggest?"
Ozorn consulted with the gold bead at the end of one of his braids. That week's color scheme was gold, dark blue, and black.
"She has been admiring the bracelet you wear, and the necklace you made for Fozzie."
Aram looked at the prince with admiration.
"Where would I be without you?"
Ozorn chuckled.
"Surely it goes the other way."
A week later, Aram gave Varys the most delicate silver necklace he could fashion. 3 small gems hung from it. He presented it to her in a silk bag after Hulak's class one August day.
"For love, prosperity, and protection," he told her as she drew it out. "And there's no magic on it, because I know you don't like magic things on your skin."
Faris untangled the chain and held the necklace up.
"You made this for me?"
Her eyes were wide and filled with amazement. He nodded, looking at the ground.
"I tried to find a blue stone with the properties I wanted, but this seemed better."
"Would you fasten it?" she asked, nudging him. "So I can wear it?"
He knew she must fasten her necklaces all the time, but he couldn't resist her request. He stepped behind her to do up the hook, breathing in her scent as he did so. She wore woods lily scent today, just the lightest touch. It made him a little giddy.
"There,"
he said, facing her once more. She had taken a mirror from her bag and was examining herself in it.
"It's lovely,"
she cried, flinging her arms around his neck. Before he knew what was happening, she had kissed him firmly on the mouth. Preet sang, flying around them before Varys let Aram go.
"I can't wait until Gisa sees it,"
Varys told him.
"She'll die of envy."
"No, don't,"
Aram said, his head still spinning from her kiss.
"She might want me to make her one, and they're special, that's all. It takes strength to make them."
Faris looked at him.
"You said there isn't magic in it."
"I don't feel magic in it."
He shrugged.
"There isn't, but I think about them when I work on them. About the power that naturally goes with the stone and the metal. Jade and silver for money and protection. Silver for the moon."
"I knew that," Faris interrupted. "Silver for the goddess, remember?"
He smiled at her.
"And jade for love."
She blushed.
"Oh, who needs love? A mage only needs fun."
Love gets us in trouble.
Well, but you might want it someday.
And then there's the love of friends. Feeling bold, he put an arm around her neck and kissed her hair.
But it's hard, somehow, thinking about those things as I work on a piece. So don't tell her it was me.
Therese sighed. All right. She brightened. I'll tell her I've had it in my things for years and just found it again. She kissed his hand and unwound his arm. Ozorn will be wondering where we got to.
So he will, Aram agreed. And we have papers to write for Master Cosmas.
To Aram's pleasure, there were no examinations for infirmary work. Gerb, who oversaw him when Ramasu was away, pointed out sourly that every day in the infirmary was an examination. Aram didn't mind. That month he had been assigned to work in the infirmary on Friday nights, where he cleaned wounds and healed black eyes in addition to judging more serious injuries and referring these wounded to the healer best at their particular hurts. Friday night, he learned immediately, was the night many of the poor families celebrated being free of work, even if they were too exhausted to attend their temples on Saturday. What Aram liked was not so much the hectic hours, but the quieter ones near dawn. He had made a new friend at the infirmary. Okolo was a curvy, lively girl who knew what to do with a shy, lanky boy in a storage closet when the waiting area was empty and the other healers were napping or playing card games. She always knew how to make Aram feel better when a sick or wounded child came in, just as she knew to fetch Aram when a child would not calm down for one of the other healers. She was fascinated by his juggling and even learned to keep two balls of linen bandages in the air at once. At the end of the term, she told Aram she was to be reassigned to an infirmary just for children in Yamut, far to the east. They have so much poverty there, with all the fighting that goes on, she explained. But they also have healers from Jindazin and the Kapula and Natu Island countries who come to study and work there. Their ways are different than ours. She kissed him. I'd ask you to come with me. We'd have so much fun, but I know you would never leave your friends. He would have protested, but he knew she was right. The term ended. Aram was released from infirmary duty to travel with Sibo. They took a rented fisherman's boat through the harbor at Vax Gate and westward on the coast. Here they camped in a secluded cove. Over their campfire, Sibo talked about the sea and its temperament, the swift way weather could turn, and the glories of the water below the surface.
"You'll see tomorrow," she told Aram,
just before she retired to the tent their crew had raised for her.
"Later next year, I'll take you for more extended journeys. It's good to know seas and rivers. Then we'll visit lakes and the more vigorous rivers inland, unless you object."
"Never," Aram said eagerly. "It sounds wonderful." Sibo eyed Preet.
"Stop pouting, bird," she commanded. "You can't go underwater with him, and that's where we go tomorrow."
Preet croaked at the old woman. To Aram's ear, the sound was very rude.
"Preet! Manners!" he scolded.
She glared at him and croaked again, but apparently she was not too vexed. When he settled in his blankets, she cuddled into her usual place under his hair against his neck. "I love you, little bird," he whispered very quietly. He had put his bedroll down a short distance from the others. If he talked in his sleep, he didn't want anyone to know if he called out, especially if he called out a particular name, like Varisa's. Walking into the sea with Sibo in the morning required all the nerve he could muster. It was not so bad in the cove, but when he was up to his chest, an incoming wave knocked him over. He fought his way up and a yard forward.
It was harder to touch the bottom in salt water, as he found when the next wave knocked him down. He was not going to drown. He wore the mage's bubble that kept him dry and able to breathe, but he floundered like an infant on a table. Sibo made a sign in the water, one that glowed with her gift. Aram copied it and immediately went to the bottom, standing as if he were on land. Walking was more difficult. The sea pushed back at him until he copied Sibo's walk, turned slightly slantwise into the tide. Now they made progress, avoiding the creatures that lived among the rocks of the bottom and confronting the fish that came to eye them. Aram might have stayed there forever if Sibo had not pointed out that it was getting dark above. He said little as they rinsed and ate supper. He did tell Preet about it when he couldn't sleep.
"I didn't appreciate it when I came here," he told the bird. "But I was ashore then. The gods are truly wondrous to have created this world."
"Good,"
he heard a voice whisper. He looked around, but Sibo was nowhere near, and that was her voice.
"A little piety is a good thing for a boy, and sleep is a good thing for an old woman. Sleep."
Sibo woke him well before dawn to show him to a great moontide. It bared the seashell creatures, crabs, shrimp, and slugs that normally hid in water-covered crevices. Aram sketched as many as he could before they were summoned to their boat. On their way home through Thax Gates Harbor, they saw people screaming and pointing at the water. Curious, Aram went forward. One glimpse at the problem, and he yelled for Sibo. The immense brownish-green shape in the river rose, revealing its vast upper body. Preet zipped across the river and landed on the monster. Aram called on a spell that would make his voice louder.
"He is a god!" he shouted to the watchers on land. "He is Enzi, the crocodile god of the Zakoi!"
"Very flattering," the god replied. "Preet, if you will devour those insects behind my ears..."
Enzi sighed as Preet pecked at the flesh where the insects were vexing him.
"I thank you."
"How sweet," Sibo said tartly as she joined Aram. "Have you a good reason for terrifying half the city?"
"I could not find you on the river," Enzi retorted. "You were nowhere near the university, the capital, the palace, or this sewage hole. How was I to know you were jaunting about on all that salt poison?"
"Do you have something to say?" demanded Sibo. "If not, I am weary to the bone. I've gone out to sea before, and you never objected."
"This is different," Enzi told her. "Troublesome times are coming. Troublesome for us all, land and water. Danger and death come. You are needed here."
Preet rose from his head and returned to Aram.
"Thank you, child,"
Enzi said. He glared at Aram.
"And no, I have yet to find a proper gift. You may continue to look after her. Don't feed her so much."
"Enzi," Sibo said, "what kind of trouble is coming?"
"What other kind is there?" asked the god. "Blood trouble."
He smacked the water with his tail and vanished. Sibo sighed.
"I will tell those I think are serious and wary. You concentrate on your studies, and offerings to the gods might be a good idea."
The students insisted that the great storm that broke before the start of school came because the gods were cruel. It lasted all the night before and the final day of vacation, as well as the first 2 days of school. Like Lindhall's students, Aram immediately went to help with the animals. They rushed to get the outdoor creatures indoors and calm the nervous ones, as well as check that no rain leaked through to the rooms where the indoor animals were kept. The master himself muttered as he and Aram did their last check of their charges, saying,
It's too early for this, much too early.
Worried, and perhaps just a little because he wanted to, Aram left Preet indoors during a break on the first day and went to the arena-like circle where he practiced fire magic. Thunder crashed over the university. He knew a circle of protection would do him no good. He simply raised his arms and called to the lightning snakes with his gift. He didn't know how long he stood there as the rain drenched him completely. It was a while because his arms ached when he lowered them. This first edge of the storm had passed overhead, taking its thunder with it. Puzzled, he climbed up to his room. The animals sleeping there complained when he dripped on them. He apologized quickly and gathered up dry clothing. Dumping his wet clothes in the hall, he tried to remember if he had seen so much as a single bolt of lightning. He had not. The next day, he asked a number of people, including his masters, if they had seen lightning the day or night before. Some were positive they had not. Others were unsure, but were positive that they must have seen it. And still others demanded to know why he asked such a silly question. Several waves of the storm, all lightningless, as far as he could tell, passed through before it ended sometime during the third night. Lindhall's students returned the animals to their normal homes, opening weather shutters to the sun and warmer breezes. For the rest, the university was in session. Yadin scowled when a yawning Aram greeted him.
"This year, we turn to crystals, the tricksters of stone magic," he informed Aram. "If you give them so much as a moment's lapse of attention, they will slip your gift along their surfaces and tangle it into a knot you cannot undo. So wake up!"
Aram covered another yawn. Masters, all masters, did not care for excuses. Yadin snorted.
"You'd think Lindhall believes you're his only student. All right, we'll go slow, but only for today."
Aram stared at the master.
"You think I was never a student?"
Yadin demanded, his large eyes flashing.
"Now!"
He opened a small box to reveal an array of bright stones in pink, blue, green, red, violet, and yellow shades.
"No magic. Identify these, and the magic associated with them. And we'll work on your juggling. Your cross-juggling is still a little awkward."
3 days later, Aram was deciding on lunch when he noticed how whispery the dining room was. He looked around. Everyone seemed shocked. Some girls and a few boys were weeping. He hurried to his table. All of his friends were present but Ozorn. Varys was crying into a handkerchief while Gisa hugged her about the shoulders.
"I barely knew the man," Varys explained. "But he was wonderful."
"What happened?" Aram asked everyone at the table. Varys laid her hand on his arm.
"It's Prince Tillowit and his vessel and two other ships of the Western Navy," she said quietly. "That storm caught the fleet out to sea. Three ships sank. His Highness drowned."
Along with his crew and those other crews, Aram thought. Was this what Enzi meant by his warning? It must be. He thought of the prince, so alive and charming. "Black God ease his passing," he murmured. "And that of his people," the others murmured their affirmation.
"The Imperial escort came for Ozorn this morning,"
Tristan said.
12 days mourning at the palace, poor fellow. He asked if we could lend him our notes."
He looked at Aram.
"Too bad he can't borrow your notes for anything but illusions."
"Tristan, don't needle him," Varys said. "He has no control over where the masters put him. You know that by now. And why should you complain? You two share fire magic and war magic,
not to mention weapons magic and spy magic. Don't tell me differently because I saw your schedule.
Tristan glared at her.
You hold yourself very high since hobnobbing with the nobility at the games,
he retorted, his face grown hard and far less handsome.
Getting too good for us peasants?
Tristan, enough,
Gisa told him.
To Varys and Arryn, she said, we're all upset today. We have to go on morning food and morning meditations for... How many days is it, Varys?
12, just like the Imperial family mourns, the younger girl replied glumly. 3 for Mithros, 3 for the goddess, 3 for the black god, and 3 for the graveyard hag. An hour of meditation before supper, and flat bread and butter for meals. Unless you know someone inventive, the kitchens will be closed and locked.
Tristan leaned on his elbow, flashing a bright smile at Varys.
My dearest, dearest friend, he said teasingly.
Varys propped her chin on her hand.
Of course, toward the end of the 12 days, one's invention and supplies run thin.
We have a Saturday and all that. We can get a meal in the city, Gisa remarked.
Arryn was not listening. He picked at his food, thinking about lightning. If there had been no lightning here at the school, what if it had been over the fleet? He hadn't seen it over the university during all that thunder when Fozzie said the two always came together. Fozzie. She had told Chioke about lightning snakes, and Chioke had found her a job in the city that she would be a fool to resist. Such a favor put her in his debt and took her away from her university friends. Chioke liked power. He had his eye on Cosmos's place, but surely chief mage to an imperial heir was better, particularly when bad things happened to the other heirs. There were only 2 people who would listen if Arryn mentioned it to them. Sibo scowled at him when he finished.
You did not tell me, or Yadin, about the incident when Fozzie told Chioke about lightning snakes.
Arryn thought of several excuses, none of them good, and shrugged instead.
Young people and your shrugs, she snapped.
They were sitting on a log that had washed up on the riverbank. Now she picked up her walking stick and walked to the water's edge. Arryn wondered if he should follow and decided to wait instead. She returned, but she did not sit. Instead, she leaned on her staff and frowned down at him.
You saw no lightning in the storm. Felt none.
Arryn shook his head.
But there was thunder.
He nodded. Right on top of me for a bit. Even in little storms, I can see flickering in the clouds. But there was nothing this time. And I suppose I do feel a prickling as a storm advances, but only in the ones with lightning, not the mild ones. Sibo stared off into the distance. Finally, she asked,
Have you told anyone else about this storm?
Arryn snorted.
They'd make fun of me and call me...
He was about to say what they really called him, an ignorant tribesman, until he remembered that Sibo was born to a tribe. A fool, he amended. She smiled grimly.
You'll have to learn to catch yourself better than that if you mean to enter a prince's service.
A prince, Arryn thought, dismayed. Ozorn. Ozorn will have to live close to court. She patted him on the shoulder.
Tell no one. Not any masters either. I'll decide who should know. It's not just students who think only ignorant tribespeople believe in the lightning snakes. You're right to tell me, though. I think you know that. Don't worry about it any more.
But something was going on, wasn't it? Arryn asked. Someone else who knew about lightning snakes did something, or got Fozzie or someone else.
Sibo put her hand over his mouth.
and you'll keep that to yourself, too," she ordered harshly. "Understand? Or do I have to put a silence on you?"
Aram shook his head. She took her hand away.
"You are too cursed clever for your own good. Learn to hold your tongue. Now, bring up your protective spells. We're visiting the hippos."
"Do we have to?" Aram complained. But he stood and did as she ordered. He would think about her warnings later. In 12 days, the locks on the kitchen were removed. The students descended on the dining hall as locusts might on a field of wheat. Ozorn returned that night and piled his plate before joining them. Preet hopped to his shoulder once he'd eaten for a little while and began to inspect him, running her beak through his hair and over his cheek, then wandering down his arm to inspect his hand. Finished, she peeped at him until he stroked her.
"Yes, I've lost weight," he told her and his silent friends. "The Emperor is strict in his morning observances. I was more concerned for my mother's health than my own. I was finally able to persuade her physician to give her yogurt drinks during the day."
His smile was long and sly.
"He discovered he was more afraid of me than he was of the Emperor, at least in such close quarters."
The others laughed. Aram patted his friend's shoulder, but something about that smile and the flicker in Ozorn's eyes disturbed him. He dismissed the feeling. Doubtless the healer was made nervous because Ozorn was now second in line for the throne and too powerful to offend.
"How fares His Imperial Majesty?" Gisa asked. "The shock of losing another heir must be dreadful."
"He does as well as any man who began the decade with 7 heirs and now has 2.
Ozorn replied.
"Now please, everyone, let me eat."
The others laughed and obeyed, turning to talk of their classes. Ozorn listened, his eyes alert, even as he devoured the contents of his plate. Once he'd finished, he sat back with a sigh.
"You'll help me catch up, won't you?"
he asked Aram. Diop, their old roommate, was seated with friends at the next table. He looked over at them, a strange light in his eyes.
"There's a laugh,"
he told his companions, his voice loud enough to be heard by everyone nearby.
"I'm surprised they don't arrange for him to take all of His Highness's examinations."
Ozorn tapped the table with his finger as he half turned in his chair.
"I don't recall anyone asking you to join our conversation," he said mildly,
despite that tapping finger.
"I have yet to hear it said that I have not done very well on my own."
Diop sniffed. His table mates were trying to hush him, but his voice got louder.
"But now you need not bother. Only command your freak to manage your studies for you, Your Highness." "You are even more obnoxious than you were when you lived in our quarters,"
Ozorn replied, his eyes not wavering from Diop's face. His fingers still drummed the surface of the table.
"For your information, the 3 of us have shared classes and work for a number of terms. I have yet to see you in our classes."
"Did you have to pay so the other 2 could share your classes?"
Diop asked, his voice full of rude suggestion. Ozorn lifted the finger he had been drumming and pointed to the doors.
"Out,"
he ordered quietly. Diop stared at him for a long moment. None of the students who were listening seemed to breathe. Then he gathered his book bag.
"You're not Emperor," he said, his voice shaking. "And the 3 of you are nothing special."
He spat on the table and walked out.
"Well," Barisa's voice shook. "Somebody sat on a snake."
"People are jealous," Tristan murmured with a shrug. "They would like to get to know Prince Ozorn better, but, Highness, you limit your circle to Aram, Varys, Sometimes Gisa and me, and anyone we may be courting, people grow bitter.
Ozorn's eyes glinted sharply.
I won't have my friendships dictated by the likes of Diop Beha. There is advantage to be had, Your Royal Highness,
Tristan replied simply.
Perhaps not with Diop, but with others. You could use allies.
Ozorn looked at Tristan, but said nothing. Aram said wistfully,
I should like to know what put the burr in Diop's anus.
As Ozorn and Gisa choked on their drinks, Aram explained,
He never liked us, but he hasn't gone after us for months.
He was kept back this year, Varys said, stacking her dishes and placing them tidily on her tray. At least half of our first-year Upper Academy class has been kept back. Maybe you only looked at your marks, with the fasting and the prince's memorials, but I look at all the marks. Every fall class is reduced by a good number. The students are held back, or some go home, or switch schools.
When Aram stared at her, Tristan said dryly,
Here is where the winnowing starts. Each term, more of us will be left behind to repeat the one before. Not all mages are equal. Surely you knew that.
Aram had known it in a vague way. Since it never had anything to do with him or his friends, he hadn't spent time worrying about it. He barely knew what year he was in these days.
Forget Diop,
Ozorn said, putting a hand on Aram's arm and on Varys's.
I'm just delighted to be back where I belong. Tell me all the gossip.
They talked school and palace gossip until Gisa reminded them of the night's studying yet to be done. When they scattered, Ozorn looked more vigorous than he had when he'd first sat down at the table. Late that night, Aram woke and found it hard to go back to sleep. Resolving to find the most boring volume on Lindhall's shelves to put him in the right frame of mind, he pulled on his robe, called up a ball of light, and wandered into the study. He was shocked to find Ozorn curled up on the floor between Lindhall's great chair and the table covered with enamel pieces. He had his head on his knees, while with one hand he was scratching Lindhall's large land tortoise, Sunstone, on the head. The animal was leaning against Ozorn's side, making soft sounds of contentment. Ozorn, too, was making sounds. But to Aram, it sounded as if his friend was weeping. He reached in a pocket and found one of several handkerchiefs. Gently he poked it through an opening between Ozorn's free hand and his knees, then sat with the table between them. He didn't want Ozorn to feel crowded. If he wanted to talk, he would. At last the prince raised his face and scrubbed his eyes with his handkerchief.
Tell anyone you caught me crying, and I'll tell Varys you fart in bed.
He blew his nose.
And I'll remind her that you will say anything if you're trying to get revenge. Which of us do you think she'll believe?
Aram reminded his friend. Ozorn lowered his knees. Immediately Sunstone climbed into his lap. His host sighed and helped the great animal to get his hind feet up, then spread the handkerchief on the table neatly. Tugging the corners into shape, he murmured,
Why did he have to die? I liked him. The others I don't care about. Mikrom? Well, the less said about him, the less vexation to the gods. He'll be emperor after all. But Stillowit was always decent when he was around. When I was little, he'd take me out on his ships and name all the parts for me. If he caught Mikrom bullying me or anyone else, he'd give them what he called sailor's brew.
He raised a hand and tapped it lightly against one of his eyes.
And now we can't even bury him. He's...
The tears were coming again. Ozorn covered his eyes with his arm.
He's at the bottom of the sea.
I liked him too, Aram said, even if he kissed Varys's hand too many times.
He was generous with the plague infirmaries and the children.
And a valiant captain in battle,
Ozorn said mournfully.